Okay, well, let's go ahead and come into our text for the evening. We're in 1 Kings chapter 12. We've been watching the downfall of tyranny with Athaliah. We got into talking last time about when do you resist a tyrannical government. And it's interesting if you read about the foundation of our country, some of the things that get said about it, because it's not like our founding fathers all of a sudden, or for whimsical purposes, just said, you know what, I don't like this government telling us what to do. Let's overthrow it and start something else. In fact, they plainly tell us in the Declaration of Independence that mankind is a lot more prone to enduring many, many hardships from a government than they are to overthrow a government, and there's good reason for that. Because even the worst form of government is better than anarchy. Now, when mankind is left to his sinful nature with no external restraint, things get really bad. And so even the most tyrannical types of government are better than no government whatsoever. And one point I wanted to make last week and didn't get to that point, but when we talk about resisting a tyrannical government, and our founders understood this too, and I think it's a very, very biblical principle. We're never talking about an individual resisting the government. Now, you might say, like Peter did, I have to obey God rather than men, and you do what God says. But when the government comes and says, you've broken our law, we're going to punish you, that's not the time to take up arms and call for a revolution. That's the time to say, yes, I realize I broke man's law, but God's law is more important, so I'll endure whatever punishment you give me. And when you're talking about, like the founders did, overthrowing one form of government, you're talking about establishing another one, and you're talking about a revolution always under the auspice of some other form of government. So it wasn't just individual colonists rising up against the British Parliament. It was an elected government, the Continental Congress, and the individual colonies' legislatures that voted to overthrow Britain. So it wasn't the individuals acting. The individuals joined the army to support a government that they had elected. So we're not talking about individuals acting in rebellion. That's bad. That's anarchy. But when you have what sometimes is called lesser magistrates, so it's maybe not the king, but it's somebody under him resisting the king, then there's a legitimate point to be made about resisting tyranny, especially when you're talking about defending other people from loss of life or something violent like that. So anyway, that was a point I wanted to make. And as we come to Athaliah, she has been overthrown. I lost his name. I'm sorry. No, I'm thinking of the high priest, and I need to find his name here. Because they all start with J's. Jehoiada. Yeah, Jehoiada, the priest. Jehoiada? Yeah. 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 Patricia, what were you talking? Your great-granddaughter has got a long name, right? Netheris Addison Gosalny.
That long?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I said, I thought it was bad when I was going to school to write Patricia Whitmore. And her mother is a teacher.
So she's going to spend a lot of time filling out filling out those forms, huh? Well, Jehoiada overthrows Athaliah. He crowns the young boy Joash as king. And when Athaliah comes running into the temple screaming, treason, treason, he says, that's exactly what I was thinking. So since you're a treasonous person, Athaliah, we're going to execute you. And he has her seized and dragged out of the temple and executed, and that's in verse 16 of 2 Kings chapter 11. So we get to 2 Kings 11:17. 2 Kings chapter 11, verse 17. Jehoiada made a covenant between the Lord and the king and the people that they should be the Lord's people, and also between the king and the people. See, this is the reestablishment of government. because it had been overthrown by a usurper for the last 7 years, and so now they're reaffirming both the Mosaic covenant and they're reaffirming the Davidic covenant by establishing a Davidic son as the king over Jerusalem. And so that required the agreement of the people to recommit to obeying David's son. It required an agreement from the people to recommit to obeying the law of God, because they had been forsaking it for a while here because of Athaliah's rulership. So verse 18, then all the people of the land went to the house of Baal and tore it down. Now where do you think the house of Baal may have come from? Yeah, it might have, but actually I think it was Jehoshaphat that allowed it to be built because of his connection with Ahab. And so this thing had crept its way into Jerusalem and close by to the temple of God, where the name of God dwells in great glory. The people of Israel had also built a temple to Baal, the god of the Canaanites, the storm god. And so they realize that that's a contradiction. We can't have both Baal worship and the worship of Jehovah side by side. And so let's go tear down this house. So they go over there, they tear down the house, they tore it down, his altars, his images, they broke in pieces, and they killed Matan, the priest of Baal, before the altars. And so much for a First Amendment guarantee of freedom of religion, right? They say there's going to be one religion in Jerusalem and in Judea, and that's going to be the worship of Jehovah according to the Mosaic covenant. So they execute the high priest and the priest posted watchmen over the house of the Lord. So they're reestablishing temple worship as well. David helped divide the Levites into different sections who would be responsible for different things. So he had groups of Levites that were singers, like the sons of Asaph. And he had Levites who were guards over the temple. So as Jehoiada, the priest, is reestablishing government here, he's also reestablishing the function of the temple. And so he took the captains, the Kerites, we said that's the king's personal bodyguards, the guards and all the people of the land, and they brought the king down from the house of the Lord, marching through the gate of the guards to the king's house. And he took his seat on the throne of the kings. Now, how old is this fella? 7 years old, and they're sitting him on the throne. And but largely, that's going to be symbolic until he's of an age to start making just decisions by himself. So all the people of the land rejoiced, and the city was quiet after Athaliah had been put to death with the sword at the king's house. So the end of this usurper results in a nice, quiet reign, and Joash begins to sit on the throne. So verse 21 is in the Hebrew text. That's actually verse 1 of chapter 12, but in our English Bibles, they labeled it as verse 21 of chapter 11. Joash was 7 years old when he began to reign. In the seventh year of Jehu, Jehoash began to reign. Remember, Jehoash is a lengthened form of Joash. So if you want to save yourself a syllable, you can call him Joash instead of Jehoash. And shouldn't be too confusing. But remember, Jehu is the one who executed judgment against Ahab's house. He's been reigning in the northern kingdom for 6 years now, and that's when Joash begins to sit on the throne of Judah. And that brings us into another whole new era. Because we've seen a lot of turbulence and upheaval. Just look at the number of times the kingdom changed hands here over this 20-some year period. We went from Jehoshaphat to Jehoram reigning together to just Jehoram reigning, and then he died, and Ahaziah, his son, took over, and then he died, and then Athaliah took over, and she died, and now we've got Joash sitting on the throne, and we're going to enter a period of much greater stability for the southern kingdom. Because how long is Joash going to reign over Judah? 40 years. That's a good long time. 40 years. Of course, I guess it depends on whether or not he's a good king or a bad king, right, Eldon?
He got an early start.
He did get an early start, right. So if he sits on the throne at 7, he only reigns for 40 years. He has a nice long rule, but he actually dies pretty young. He's only 47 years old when he passes away. But at the same time, that is a good long rule. That's going to bring a lot of stability and prosperity to the southern kingdom. If if he's a good king. What do you think? Pete, is he going to be a good king or a bad king? You think he's going to be a good one? Okay, we'll find out. His mother's name was Zibiah of Beersheba. And Jehoash did what was right in the eyes of the Lord all his days, because Jehoiada the priest instructed him. So, pause for a moment and think about this statement. How long of Joash's reign is Jehoiada high priest? It's most of it, right? He does right all the days of his reign because Jehoiada instructed him. That means for most of Joash's reign, Jehoiada is high priest. Now, got to think through this. How old do you have to be when you become high priest? You had to be 30 to become the high priest, okay? Or to begin serving as priest. And so probably you'd be a little older. So that's at least 30 plus 40 years, because Jehoiada is the one that sets Joash on the throne. So he's at least going to be 70 years old when he passes away. But in fact, if we would turn to 2 Chronicles chapter, where'd it go? Oh, I've got the wrong chapter there. One second. It's chapter 24. 2 Chronicles 24 tells us that that Jehoiada actually dies at 130 years old. This is 2 Chronicles 24, verse 15. Jehoiada grew old, full of days, and died. He was 130 years old at his death. So how old was he when Joash took the throne? 90 years old. Look at the energy he pours into putting Joash on the throne and organizing all of the guards and commanding Athaliah's execution. So, boy, how'd you like to have that kind of energy at 90 years old? What's that? Like Moses, right? Yep. Well, he outlives Moses, doesn't he? Moses makes it to 120. But, yeah, it does say that Moses was not diminished at all, even in his old age. Go ahead, Eldon. That's right. He was well fed. Huh? Well, that means, let's do a little tracing backwards. So if Jehoiada is 90 years old here when Joash takes the throne, that means he was 83 when Athaliah took the throne, which means he was 83. Let's go back another 8 years. So he's 75 when Jehoram takes the throne, and that's 21 years after Jehoshaphat. So he was 54 when Jehoshaphat took the throne, which means he was, Asa reigned 41 years, which means he saw the entirety of Asa's reign. So, 41, we said he was 54, so that leaves us with 13 years, which means he saw Abijah's reign, and he was born in Rehoboam's reign, right about here. Yeah, he was born just 10 years after the kingdom divided. Think of all that history this guy has seen. So probably he took the high priesthood somewhere either toward the end of Asa's reign or maybe at the beginning of Jehoshaphat's reign. But he definitely saw a lot in his lifetime. Eldon.
I find that very encouraging.
Good.
Ways to go yet.
Yeah. Well, how many years have you attained here, Eldon?
76.
You're 76. So imagine having almost double that. Having another 60 years to go. Wouldn't that be something? Dan, you said one of the ladies at Kids Club turns 100 next Sunday, right? Or this coming Sunday. The Sunday after today. We'll put it that way. All right. Well, Jehoiada has a great influence on Joash, so much so that the writer of the Kings says that that Joash did right all the days that Jehoiada was alive, because Jehoiada instructed him. How important is it, the people to whom you listen for advice? How important are the teachers that you choose to listen to? Very. They can have a huge impact on your thinking. And none of us is beyond being led into error. And so that is a really important point in life, to make sure that those influences in your life that you allow to instruct your thinking are godly influences. Like Psalm 1 says, "Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the way of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates both day and night." Those are talking about what kinds of people and things you allow to influence your thinking. And so Joash here becomes this example of it, because actually what we're going to see happen is that when Jehoiada dies, Joash starts listening to some other people, and it doesn't go well for him. He gets classed as a righteous king. It says he did right in the eyes of the Lord all his days, but toward the end of his life, maybe just the last year or two, he begins to make some very bad decisions. And the change is very drastic from what he starts out as. But he starts off as a righteous man. Let's take a look at some of the things that he does. Verse 4, Jehoash said to the priests, "All the money of the holy things..." Oh, wait, I'm sorry. I skipped a couple verses, didn't I? I'm sorry. Let's go back to 2 Kings 12. Okay? We're going to go back to 2 Kings 12 and pick up with verse 2. Jehoash did what was right in the eyes of the Lord all his days, because Jehoiada the priest instructed him. Nevertheless, the high places were not taken away, and the people continued to sacrifice and make offerings on the high places. This has been a problem since Israel entered the land. They were supposed to worship only at the temple in Jerusalem, but they continued to set up little altars and chapels on tops of the mountains. Okay, so God was being very, very patient with his people and putting up with a lot from them. Verse 4, Jehoash said to the priests, "All the money of the holy things that is brought into the house of the Lord, the money for which each man is assessed, the money from the assessment of persons, and the money that a man's heart prompts him to bring into the house of the Lord, let the priests take each from his donor, and let them repair the house wherever any need of repairs is discovered." Why do you think we need to start making repairs to the temple? Yeah, it's been around for a while. It probably did not get used much during Athaliah's reign, because you had the house of Baal, and you have this thing of the people are going up to all the little high places to worship, and so the temple is being neglected. Now, what is this issue of the money from the assessment of persons? What's he talking about? Which tax? It is a tax, but it's a specific one. Eldon? The temple tax, right. Anytime one of the kings or the rulers decided to take a census, it had to come with a half a shekel per person tax. Didn't matter if you were rich or poor, if they did a census, then you had to pay this tax. So hopefully they wouldn't decide to do a census too often, because it would get very expensive, right? But that was the way that every person participated in the maintenance of the temple. And that money would go to the tabernacle or the temple for its operation. And this was aside from free will offerings, and some of the sacrifices came with other offerings and things. This was aside from the yearly tithe that was to be paid as well. Eldon?
Wasn't this the tax that Jesus paid with the coin out of the fish?
Yes, yeah. This would be the temple tax that Jesus paid with the coin out of the fish, right. It's probably also, it could be one of the reasons that David brought a plague on Israel, because he took a census of people and didn't collect the temple tax. We're not sure of that. It could just be that David's heart was being ingrained in pride, wanting to know how many soldiers he had. But there's no mention in that census of taking the temple tax. And so Joash is saying, hey, take that temple tax and start applying it to repairing the house of the Lord, as well as what the free will offerings that come in. Verse 5, let the priests take each from his donor and let them repair the house wherever any need of repairs is discovered. Verse 6, but by the 23rd year of King Jehoash, the priests had made no repairs on the house. So that jumps us all the way up here to the 23rd year, and the temple is not being repaired. The same year, Jehu passes away, and his son Jehoahaz, takes the rulership of the northern kingdom. So now we have this fun thing going on where you have a king of the north with the same name as the king of the south, Jehoahaz. Okay? Lots of fun, or Jehoahash. But lots of fun stuff, trying to keep those all straight. But 23 years into his reign, how old is King Joash now? He's 30. We don't know when he gave the order to start rebuilding the temple and repairing it, but by the time he's more than halfway through his reign, it hasn't been finished yet. The priests, a couple of scenarios that could be happening. Number one, the priests may have been pilfering some of the money. It's a possibility. We hope not. What's also a possibility is that the temple tax simply was not bringing in enough money because the temple tax was also there to fund the temple's daily operations. And so it could be that they just simply weren't bringing in enough money to fund operations and make the repairs. So whatever it is, it's not happening. The repairs aren't being done. And so, verse 7, therefore King Jehoash summoned Jehoiada the priest with the other priests and said to them, why are you not repairing the house? Now therefore take no more money from your donors, but hand it over to the repair of the house. So the priest agreed that they should take no more money from the people and that they should not repair the house. That they should not repair the house. Yeah. So then Jehoiada the priest, they decided, they're just going to cancel this building operation, at least the way that King Joash wanted it to happen. But Jehoiada the priest has another idea, so he took a chest and bored a hole in the lid of it, set it beside the altar on the right side as one entered the house of the Lord. And the priests who guarded the threshold put in it all the money that was brought into the house of the Lord. And whenever they saw that there was much money in the chest, the king's secretary and the high priest came up and they bagged and counted the money that was found in the house of the Lord. And then they would give that the money that was weighed out into the hands of the workers who had the oversight of the house of the Lord. And they paid it out to the carpenters and the builders who worked on the house of the Lord, and to the masons and the stonecutters, as well as to buy timber and quarry the stone for making repairs to the house of the Lord or for any outlay for the repairs of the house. So here's this new idea. Here's how we're going to fund it. We're just going to put a box there, and anybody that wants to contribute specifically to the temple maintenance fund can now do so. And apparently it works very well. So that's where we got our Joash fund. That's right. Eldon.
We have the box.
Yeah, that's right. We used to have a box, didn't we? Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we still call it the Joash Fund. I forgot that we used to have a box for that. So, from free will offerings specifically to this, right? Yep. And so, great example to it. And so they just started taking up free will offerings. So the normal money that was coming in, probably not sufficient to complete the repairs as well as fund the ongoing work of the temple. So they just decided to take in these free will offerings, and it works. So every time the box got full, not only would the high priest send somebody to count the money, but so would the king. And they would come in, they would count the money, just like we have two people go back and count our offerings, just to make sure that everything's on the up and up. And then they would commit it into the hands of the workers to begin the repairs.
This is the king. Why would it take money to make the repairs? Does the king
just say, make the repairs? You got to pay the workers. He could if you want to make people really mad. Yeah. They did have some slave labor, but typically speaking, even slaves have to be fed. They only work so long before they collapse, right? And so, yeah, the work has to be paid for somehow, but Israel was a very relatively free nation. And so the workers had to be compensated for the work that they did, and the materials had to be purchased, right? So even if you did have slaves working some of it, typically your slaves weren't your skilled workers. They were your grunts carrying stones and wood and things. So you had to feed them. And the law of God, the law of Moses put a clamp on slavery and how much of it could exist. And even we talk about slaves in the Mosaic law, and people get all over the Bible and say, well, it's okay with slavery. We don't like that. But the slavery under the Mosaic law, Jewish people that had to sell themselves as a slave to you to pay a debt, not only did their work pay for the debt they owed you, but you still had to pay them a wage so that they didn't leave empty-handed. God was very clear that slavery under his system of government was not going to be absolute slavery. Eldon. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Near as I can tell, they give their land to a contractor and use it to contract them for the building.
Mm-hmm.
And he disappeared with money.
Yep. When I was in Pennsylvania at Salina Bible Church in Pennsylvania, we were working on a building program, and we had an architect draw up all the plans. And I think we had $30,000 or so wrapped up in plans for this new building, and the contractor kind of disappeared and never did get anything out of that. Couldn't use the plans because he didn't finish them, and he just walked away with $30,000 of our money. So it happens at times, right? But we get this great statement here that, verse 14, what was given to the workmen who were repairing the house of the Lord, they did not ask for an accounting from the men into whose hand they delivered the money to pay out the workmen, for they dealt honestly. Boy, wouldn't you just love to work in that kind of economy where you could trust your workers. You didn't have to worry about it and write contracts and keep receipts and all those things. They were honest men, and they didn't have to keep a strict accounting of it. Verse 16, the money from the guilt offerings and the money from the sin offerings was not brought into the house of the Lord. It belonged to the priests. So what we have there from the beginning of the chapter to the end of the chapter is a change in how we're going to fund this temple repair. They realized that just using the temple tax wasn't enough to do the repairs on the temple, so they started asking for freewill offerings to fund the repair of the temple. And so things are going along pretty well. Now, verse 17 tells us at that time, if we want to build a little bit of a context for what at that time means, we can turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 24. So 2 Chronicles chapter 4 almost word for word mirrors what we just read. Joash is set on the throne at 7 years old. He does right before the Lord all his days that Jehoiada is the priest. He tries to repair the temple. It doesn't quite work, so they have to adjust their strategy and start again. And then things start to go forward. In verse 15 is where things start to go a little bit differently. So we read here, Jehoiada grew old, full of days, and died. He was 130 years old in his death. That's a detail the writer of Kings doesn't give us. But we were told that he did right all the days of Jehoiada the priest because Jehoiada taught him. So what does this tell us now? Joash is no longer listening to Jehoiada the priest because Jehoiada is dead. So let's see what begins to happen. Verse 16, they buried him in the city of David among the kings because he had done good in Israel and toward God in his house. So here's a high priest that gets buried in the tomb of the kings because of the influence that he had on the nation throughout all these years. But verse 17, now after the death of Jehoiada, the princes of Judah came and paid homage to the king, and then the king listened to them. And they abandoned the house of the Lord, the God of their fathers, and served the Asherim and idols. And wrath came upon Judah and Jerusalem for this guilt of theirs. Yet he sent prophets among them to bring them back to the Lord. These testified against them, but they would not pay attention. So here's what's going on in the latter part of Joash's reign. Now, it took 23 years to get to the point where they had to change their strategy for repairing the temple. And then we have some more time where the temple's actually getting repaired. But at some point between this 23-year mark and this 40 mark, Jehoiada dies. We have that noted down here. That's this little ellipsis. Somewhere in here, Jehoiada dies, and Joash begins to turn to the council of the princes of Judah rather than to the council of his friend Jehoiada. And so, as an example of how his allegiances have turned, we get this little story starting in verse 20. The Spirit of God clothed Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada the priest, and he stood above the people and said to them, "Thus says the Lord, why do you break the commandments of the Lord so that you cannot prosper? Because you have forsaken the Lord, he has forsaken you. But they conspired against him, and by the command of who? By whose command does the next action happen? By the command of the king, they stoned him with stones in the court of the house of the Lord. Thus, Joash the king did not remember the kindness that Jehoiada, Zechariah's father, had shown him, but he killed his son. And when he was dying, he said, "May the Lord see and avenge." So here is the turning point of Jehoash. For all these years, he's followed the Lord because Jehoiada told him what was right. But here toward the end, he starts to side with all the princes of Judah. And when God sends a prophet, Zechariah, Joash has him stoned in the temple. That's quite a drastic change, isn't it? Well, that's what's going on back in 2 Kings when it says about this time. Because back in 2 Kings, something else begins to happen. It says, "At this time, Hazael, king of Syria, went up and fought against Gath and took it. But when Hazael set his face to go up to Jerusalem, Jehoash, king of Judah, took all the sacred gifts that Jehoshaphat and Jehoram and Ahaziah, his fathers, the kings of Judah, had dedicated, and his own sacred gifts, and all the gold that was found in the treasuries of the house of the Lord and of the king's house, and sent these to Hazael, king of Syria. Then Hazael went away from Jerusalem." I was just reading out of 2 Kings 12. So, remember Hazael? Who anointed Hazael to be king of Syria? Elisha. Yeah, God told Elijah to do it, but it didn't get done until Elisha was the main prophet. So Elisha anoints Hazael to be king of Syria. So we are, well, I can't zoom out, can I? Yes, there I can. That happens sometime around here because he anoints Hazael king of Syria right about the time he anoints Jehu king of the northern kingdom. So Hazael has been on the throne for quite a while now. He's the king of Syria, and he's been a problem the whole time. Well, Hazael comes down the coastal region here and attacks Gath. If you remember, there was a little statement not too long ago that talked about how Hazael came down and took all the northern cities of northern Israel and all of Ramoth-Gilead. So Hazael has occupied all of this territory over here to the east, everything up here in the Jezreel Valley and around the Sea of Galilee, and now he's marching southward along the coastal region. So that just leaves this central hill land to the northern kingdom and then the southern kingdom of Judah. But he gets all the way down here and he takes Gath. Now, what do we know about Gath? Eldon. It was a Philistine city originally. And then I think Jehoshaphat conquered it. And so it's been a Judean city for a few years. But it was originally a Philistine city. And so this is the outskirts of Judah that Hazael is attacking. And so it says he takes Gath and then he comes up against Jerusalem. So he has marched his way up the mountains and he's threatening Jerusalem. This is the time during which Joash the king is not walking before the Lord in integrity. So God is using Hazael as an instrument of judgment to discipline his people. How does Joash deal with the problem? Okay, in a very bad way. What's he do? Yeah. He pilfers all the temple. You know all that thing he spent the first 30 years of his reign doing, trying to rebuild the temple? He pilfers it. Takes everything out of it, takes everything out of the king's house, and he impoverishes Jerusalem in order to get Hazael to leave him alone. And in fact, if we would jump back to the Second Chronicles passage, it tells us that there actually was a battle that went on, that King Joash is wounded in that battle, and that this was forced on him to pillage Jerusalem. So probably Hazael brings the Syrian army very close to Jerusalem, and Joash is wounded in a battle, and so Hazael sends the terms of surrender. I want everything valuable in Jerusalem. You send it out to me, and I'll go leave you alone. And so Joash complies with that, pilfers Jerusalem, the temple, the king's house. Everything valuable in the city is taken away, and God uses Hazael to impoverish and embarrass and humiliate the southern kingdom of Judah. So, verse 19, now the rest of the acts of Joash and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? His servants rose and made a conspiracy and struck down Joash in the house of Millo on the way that goes down to Silah. It was Jozachar, the son of Shimeoth, and Jehozabad, the son of Shomer, his servants, who struck him down so that he died. And they buried him with his fathers in the city of David, and Amaziah, his son, reigned in his place. Interesting little tidbit. Again, when you go back to the Chronicles passage, one of these guys, one of these servants, is a Moabite, and the other one is an Ammonite. And so these two guys are from nations that traditionally were enemies of Israel. And so they rise up while Joash is wounded. Chronicles tells us that they kill him while he's in bed. And so he's wounded from the battle with Hazael, and they rise up and kill him. And so they hand the kingdom over to his son, Amaziah. And so Joash's reign starts off really, really good, but it ends really, really badly. Eldon.
I have had a lot of questions in my mind about that. And reading through that, I question whether Joash was really fit to be a ruler because of the fact that as long as the priest told him what to do, he was fine. He had no initiative on his own.
Yep.
And the question is, I asked me, is the man mentally retarded? And as long as he was under the influence of the priest, he did good. And as soon as he was under the influence of other people, he completely went the other way. He had no good judgment on his own.
Yeah, I don't think that it mentions or tells us that he had a mental incapacity. But how many of us have a moral incapacity? I mean, how many of you like to stand against other people when they're telling you to go one way? It's not easy to do. In fact, it's very, very hard to do. And it depends on how close you are to the people, how much you care about their opinion of you. But it does show a moral failing of Joash that he couldn't stand on his own two feet. You would hope that by the time he's 45 years old, he would have been able to make determinations of right and wrong on his own, but he didn't. Well, that's a good question, because those are what shape you, aren't they? Yep. Now, he came to the throne in a hard way, so we know his first 6 years of life were not great, but doesn't it tell us something, too, that in the first 6 years of his life, his parents are not the ones having a great influence on him. He has to be raised in the temple. That in itself has an effect on you. But we're also dealing with the fact that he is a son of Ahaziah, a wicked king. And he's the son he's not the son of Athaliah. But he comes from that household. This is a wicked household that he's coming from originally. So Jehoshaphat was a righteous king, but he married off his son to the daughter of Ahab. And Amaziah comes into play, and he's not exactly a righteous king either. So we have this idea of the sins of the fathers visiting the children to the third and fourth generation, and Joash is the second or the third generation from that. And so we have some of these family problems lingering around, and they're going to linger for just a little bit longer. So yeah, there's a lot going on there, but none of us is an island. Lots of things affect us, but it does tell us that even if you have Even if you have problems that go back several generations in your family, you know, we're still responsible for what we do. Joash could have chosen to do right. For whatever reason, he didn't. He chose to go the way of the young princes of Jerusalem. But it ought to be a caution to us about who you listen to and to whom you let give you counsel. Who's got your ear? And hopefully we are people that are allowing ourselves to be influenced by godly counsel, not by scoffing counsel. You know, read again, Psalm 1. It's a great, great passage. And so Joash is a good example to us of somebody that doesn't follow the principles of Psalm 1. And he does. His kingdom becomes not like a tree that's planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in its season, and all that he does prospers, his leaf doesn't wither, but he becomes like the second example. They're like chaff that the wind drives away. And so his kingdom comes to a bitter end because of those decisions. Any questions, any other questions or comments about Joash?